Hey folks, this is LJ, your opinionated host for the Opine Motel podcast. Hope you're well. Let's get into it. So, welcome back, folks. This is episode 4, or if you put it in brackets, because it's a follow-up Q&A to episode 2, it's episode 2.1. So, today we're doing a Q&A on the how to tame, cage, and live with your monkey mind. You've been very generous with your feedback. I've had so many questions being sent over to me. I've honed it down to kind of a top 5, and I'm going to obviously ping out some answers today, give my opinion on some of your questions. If this works out and you still want more, if there's a lot more questions or there's things that I haven't answered, what I might do is I might extend it. And as I said in my first introduction, I might even make it 2.2. So we'll see how it goes. And yeah, you can give me your feedback on how this works. Great. So, well, let's get into the questions. So the first question comes from Jane in Portland, Oregon. So thanks, Jane. She says, my entire family suffers from anxiety, which means it must be genetic, at least partially. How can I even start to think about beating genetics? Well, thanks very much for your question. Well, let me start off by saying, look, despite there being some evidence for genetic susceptibility for certain disorders, there has never been a specific gene that has been unambiguously identified for any common form of mental disorder. None. So many researchers believe that this is due in part to the critical role that the environment plays in modulating this susceptibility. So a term you may or may not have heard of is epigenetics. And epigenetics is outside factors beyond the DNA transcription that makes you and the expression of the genes that make up you. So for instance, what we're seeing is that while a gene may or may not be expressed, it also depends on the environmental pressure from the outside on whether, one, it is expressed, two, whether there's an altered form of that expression, and even three, what we're finding is that there are downstream effects. So that, for instance, if one gene has been exposed to, say, a pesticide in the past, subsequent generations, and obviously created an altered protein, subsequent generations then still express the same altered genes, even though they've never experienced the pesticide firsthand themselves. So it's a vastly complicated picture. And what we need to start thinking about is removing this cult of reductionism, this idea that it's nature versus nurture. This is a lovely concept and a lovely soundbite for morning news shows or entertainment shows that love to pit one thing against another. And that works well for clickbait and, you know, viewer eyeballs and all the rest of it, but really has no relevance in science. This has been put to bed for many years, that it's never one or the other. I mean, if I give you a specific example, schizophrenia, which has a greater preponderance of genetic heritability or perceived genetic heritability. Researchers have known for many years that first-degree biological relatives of patients with schizophrenia have around about a 10% risk of developing the disorder compared to just 1% in the general population. So that's only a 10-to-1 difference. And the identical twin of a person with schizophrenia has only about a 40 to 50% risk. And remember, they pretty much have identical DNA. So even in the worst case scenario, where you've pretty much got exactly the same genome, there's only a maximum of 50%. So that means there's 50% of something else that can potentially determine whether you have schizophrenia. So what this breaks down to is how complicated the picture is. And with the reductionism that I mentioned on both of those sides, they fail to appreciate the complexity of the interaction among biology, psychology, and the social setting. And psychology today has basically broken down some of the figures. The brain is the most complicated thing in the known universe. It contains more than 100 billion neurons, equal to the number of stars in our galaxy. each firing dozens to 100 times a second, each connected to each other by 240 trillion synapses. I mean, these numbers are mind-boggling. It's almost impossible to get your head around what these numbers mean. So there's no way that our 20,000 genes could, in any simple top-down fashion, instruct the intricate wiring and firing of so many connections. So bring it back round to your initial question, how can I beat my genetics? Well, hopefully, Jane, I've kind of shown you that you don't need to try and beat your genetics. It's only one component. And also what is maybe another thing to consider is that, well, if you do have generations in your family that either have suffered anxiety or are struggling with the monkey mind, potentially what's happening is that even as a child or moving further as you become an adult, your modeling behavior that you experienced from your parents or your friends or family or relatives, that you've then taken it upon yourself on how to deal with anxiety. And there is no roadmap. No one sits you down at school and teaches you, you know, if you have anxiety or if you're feeling a little down, this is what you should do. We just get on with it. It's that machismo kind of culture is like, just get on with it. Well, that would be just like saying, well, yeah, you've got a heart problem, just get on with it. You wouldn't go to see a cardiologist to work out what you should do, drugs and treatment options that you should look at. So there's ways and means, and hopefully there's a few of them in my last pod that can help you structure a few things that can at least take you down a different path on how to help yourself with any anxiety you may have. Hope that helped. Okay, so the next question comes in from Sam from London, UK, so my neck of the woods. I don't know if it's Samuel or Samantha, but hi, thank you very much for your question. And they say, I am 56 years old and have always been anxious and struggled with my monkey mind. How can I hope to change when I have been struggling at it for so long? It's too late for me. Well, let me start with the last bit first. It's never too late. And I know that's a glib answer and it's a throwaway answer. And it's something that, look, you can find on, you know, in a fortune cookie. But there is, I'll give you a little story. I love riding motorcycles. It's my passion. And I've met people. I met one gentleman in particular. And this chap was 84 years old. So not in the flush and prime of his life. But his dear wife had unfortunately passed the year before. And he always promised her that he would never ride a motorcycle while she was around. And he kept to that promise. But he'd always in the back of his mind thought, you know what, I wouldn't mind trying it out. And his words to me was that, look, I'm going to join my dearly departed wife pretty soon. So I might as well give it a go and see how I go. So at least I can say that I've done it. So he went and got lessons and bought himself a little bike and practice. And so at the grand old age of mid-80s, he learned how to ride a motorcycle. So it's really never too late. It's about mindset. And again, that can sound glib. How do I change my mindset? Well, hopefully on the last pod, I gave you some tips and tricks on changing that mindset, whether it comes through meditation or through that ABCD, a CBT technique that I outlined, or even just reframing the issue. So when something happens in which that you can look at it several ways, you can look at it catastrophically, that this is the end, it's all over, or this could be an opportunity. This can be something to take advantage of. This can be something in which that you can use it as a moment to grow. It's tough. It's tough because if you've been struggling for so long, what you tend to think is a certain fixed thinking. There's certain patterns and our brains are very good at the pattern recognition machines, and it's very good at creating a new pattern. The pattern is crisis or whatever, fill in the blank, X happens, and you already have, your brain has already preloaded a a tape of or a set of instructions for what you should do next. And it's that transition from when the activating an event happens to the actions that follow that activating event. And again, you can say I'm coming back to that ABCD technique. That's at the point in which that you can intervene and change your course on how to change your life, change your mind, cope a little bit. And look, all these things take time. I'm not going, it's not a magic pill. There is no way of instantly flipping from one day to the next. But over time, Sam, what you will find is the next time that you have, let's just say, a smaller crisis in your mind, a smaller time when your monkey is screeching, just take that opportunity to just press pause. And literally almost press pause. And again, write it down on a piece of paper. It doesn't need to be the full technique, but just write down what are you anxious about or what is your monkey screaming about? And then outline options. Outline a positive option, outline a negative option, outline a neutral option, something that doesn't change it either way. And even there, by putting it on paper, you can see at least you've got three options. You can act positively, you can act negatively, you can act neutrally, and you can actually, let me just add this fourth one. You can put in your normal response to that event and then see how that works for you. That's a way to start to change. I mean, there are a lot of different ways of changing of changing that kind of fixed behavior, but it's never too late. And honestly, if there's one takeaway, even if it sounds like a fortune cookie, it's never too late for you to change or do anything. If anything, neuroplasticity has shown that the brain is constantly, almost the day you die, is essentially growing new neurons, new axons, new dendrites in your brain to create new connections, which means that you can change physically your brain all the way to the end. So it's just about giving it a different program, giving it a different set of instructions, and then seeing it where it takes you. I hope that's helped a little. Thanks, Sam. The next question comes from Sweden, Malmö in Sweden, and it's Stefan. And Stefan asks, our Western society fosters anxiety as we're always striving for a higher position in all that we do, always worried about things we are not winning. How can I get around that? Okay, thanks, Stefan, for your question. Well, I'd say it's all a matter of perspective, Stefan. It is something in which that intrinsically you'd have to look inside yourself and decide what you value, what's important to you. Is it money? Is it career? Is it family? Is it spending time with friends? Is it gaining new experiences? Trying out new things? Is it travel? As you can see, the list is endless. And so you have to determine for yourself what are your priorities. And I reject the term winning and losing when it comes to life. Usually those are terms narrowly defined by people like advertisers that want to sell you something, a dream, a product, a service, a widget you just can't live without. Or even the societal pressure that you must do this or you must do that, or your career must progress this way or must progress that way. These are immutable, they're not real. And if I give you an example, so if you were to say you had this dream of becoming a mountain climber, and you want to one day climb to the peak of Everest, a great goal, not a huge amount of people have done such a thing. So on your first attempt, after doing very, very little training, you make your way to base camp or to the first point up the mountain. Would you say that you've lost? I would say that you've done very well. And so you've done something that most people have not achieved. And you've done something that is worthy of acknowledgement. So what I suggest is that potentially have goals in mind that you want to achieve, so final goals, like reaching the top of Everest, and then you can break them down into bite-sized goals, ones that, again, it keeps your motivation up, it gives you a little pat on the back, so when you reach base camp, you can go, hey, I've reached base camp, well done to me, and that will spur you on for motivation to move on to the next thing or the next thing, but essentially, you still are defining what's valuable to yourself. Now, to your specific point on striving for a higher position in all that we do, that might be more of a personal striving. Not everyone is always looking for a higher position, but let's assume that is correct, that people are looking for a higher position. I would make it more personal to yourself. You're looking for a higher position because of status, because of what that status can get you with regards to remuneration in money, or in time, or in love from friends. Again, these are things that you need to define. And being worried about other people. So obviously we have two types of motivations, an intrinsic motivations and extrinsic, which by the name suggests one's internal, one's external. If you're always defining yourself by external, essentially what you're saying is, my goals are not important, but what society or all that what's imposed on me is important. And when you get caught in that loop of thinking, oh, you know, I'm not beating Mr. and Mrs. Jones next door or my colleagues at work, whatever other permutations there might be, just ask yourself, is that something that you personally wish for? And truly dig down and understand that thought. Is it something that you want, or is it something that you feel that is being imposed on you from the outside? And if it's being imposed on you from the outside, again, it's not good or bad. Those terms I reject. It's just asking, does that align with your intrinsic goals, your values, and what you want to achieve in your life? If it does, good, then carry on. Or if it doesn't, or there's some sort of conflict and rubbing together, it's like two tectonic plates coming together. They both are pushing in different directions. And at that friction point, usually is where their stress, worry, the monkey starts screeching because it feels an internal pressure that maybe you're not fully understanding or even aware of. And this clashing of these two tectonic plates, what others want of you and what you want of yourself, if you haven't fully defined it in your own mind, can be an underlying pressure that, as I said, grates and then causes certain issues to arise without you even being aware of why you're feeling this way. But it's because they're not aligned, what other people want and what you want. So maybe a better way of looking at it is to put those major goals in your mind and then work backwards from that as having little, say, mile markers. So if you're running a marathon, you could work out, oh, hey, I give myself a pat on the back after I hit 5 miles or 10 miles or 15, all the way up to the end of that 26-mile marathon. That kind of works as a better way to spur you on and works out whether what you really want, Stefan, is aligned to what you're achieving in the world. As Simon Sinek defines, there are two games. There's an infinite game and there's a finite game. So in the finite game, you can have small wins, in inverted commas, winning a game of football or basketball or chess, you can win. But in the game of life, it's an infinite game. There is no winning. So if I line up all the achievements of your life compared to someone else's life, who's won? It's very subjective. So set your own terms, set your own goals, and when you achieve them, give yourself a pat on the back and understand they're mutable and horizons and goals change even when you're halfway through a journey. So be aware that the happiness and the inverted commas winning is down to how you define it and how you wish to live your own life. Hope that helps, Stefan. Great, let's move on. So we've got Jennifer from Santa Monica, California. Thank you, Jennifer, for your question. So your question was, there is too much choice. How can I tame my monkey when there are so many choices everywhere and I don't trust myself to choose? I wish I had sliding doors. By way of context, Sliding Doors is a movie with Gwyneth Paltrow where it's set in London. She's running for a London tube. Doors are closing, and whether she gets on the tube or whether she doesn't get on the tube determines a certain different timelines and interactions with similar people within the story. So basically an analogy of going down one path or another. Right. So Jennifer, you're right. There's never been more choice, more competition for our attention, probably in the history of the world, for our brains to try and filter out. There is too much choice. And your monkey will definitely grab onto each of these little splits in the pathway. And whichever one you do choose, it will have a comment to make. And whichever one you don't choose, it will also have a comment to make. This is your brain, in one way, trying to be helpful. But if it becomes, you know, beyond a chattering, giving you options to a screeching, then obviously it's moved into that maladaptive place, which we've talked about before, in which that we need to do something to tame and tamper down that monkey. And choices are everywhere. I mean, it's not surprising given that we now live in the age of big data and social media and advertisers have got smarter. I mean, it makes sense, doesn't it? It's experience, add some time and you get a more expertise. So back in the 50s when we see, you know, Westinghouse trying to sell washing machines to housewives in the 50s, we laugh at them. They're so clunky in how they express themselves. Yet today, if we saw that same ad or some sort of Bosch, you know, washing machine now, most of the words in that ad have been focus grouped. Most of them have probably consulted a psychologist to work out the best way to grab your attention. They've worked out the color palette that will best suit the target audience that they want. It's become a sweet science in selling goods. So it encompasses a whole lot of your own willpower to stop yourself making a choice one way or the other. And it's probably a pod that I need to do later on. But willpower is a limited resource. It is a muscle that you can use. It can depend on your mood, so whether you're happy or sad, whether you're going to make a choice or not. It also depends on how many times it's had to be used within the day. It's a limited resource, so you may start out strong, but repeatedly exhibiting self-control, your willpower is depleted. You know, firstly, you need to get on with your coworker. Then you have to turn away from not having those cookies. Maybe you're thinking about, maybe I should exercise. Maybe you should pay attention to something that you're not really interested. Maybe you need to hold your tongue from what someone has said to you. So each time you're engaging that willpower, a supply available to you is depleted. And eventually, by the end of the day, and you are pretty much done. And your monkey is also utilizing the fact that you're fatigued from having to not only not make a choice, but once you do make a choice, to then co-opt the system to try and basically give you other options, whether that was correct or not. It's like your internal thinking overtakes your cognitive ability to say, yes, this was right. Another thing to consider is your thinking. So Daniel Kahneman in 2011, I believe, put out a book called Thinking Fast and Slow, which essentially summarized the work that he did as a psychologist with his colleague Amos Tversky in the 70s. And it's one of the pillars of behavioral economics. I think actually they won the the Nobel Prize for Economics for their work. But that's by the by. Essentially, what it describes is two systems in your brain in which you can obviously think fast and think slow. The fast part of the brain is ones that make quick judgments. These are the biases and heuristics, the ones that literally take the available patterns of information out there in the world and glom it into something that they can package up and neatly be filed, stored, and put away very quickly. And then you've got the slow part of your thinking. This is your Vulcan part of your thinking, the slower part where you're logically analyzing each part of that information and then making the best available use of that evidence and data to make a decision. As you can see, that second part is if you've got all the time in the world. And as I mentioned in the last pod on this monkey mind, is that we have around about 60,000 individual thoughts every day. So that would be impossible. We just don't have the time. The brain, just by good brain management, wouldn't spend all that resources on every single thought that goes through our head. It's just not a good use of time. And so understanding that you have these two processes also will help you to get a little bit of insight into understanding that sometimes when you do make a choice, it will never always be the perfect choice. The goal is to try and slow your thinking down so you move it to that second part, that slow part of your thinking. But in the moment, it's not always possible. And when you combine that with what I previously mentioned with willpower, you can see that plenty of questionable decisions can be made that in hindsight, wow, if only had 20/20 hindsight, we wouldn't have done, X or Y. So you don't need to beat yourself up about that, Jennifer. We have systems in which that, certainly in our brain, we're using wetware that essentially goes back 200,000 years or so. And we're trying to co-opt that in making it useful for the 21st century. And that's the difficult part. Now, the second part of your question mentioned trust. Now, that's something slightly different. Trust is, well, if I break it down, and again, you can come back to me if I have got the wrong end of the stick from this. But when you're talking about trust, there is no way of truly trusting to know whether that decision that you make in the moment or even after a prolonged period of time is the correct one. You don't know that. You take all that lovely summed experience from the past, from the behaviors, from the learnings and the teachings that you've gathered. You mix that in with the current present situation, and again, mixing in what the environment, what the landscape looks like at the time, and then you make a decision. That decision obviously can split into multiple different pathways in which that you have no control over, and you have no way of knowing how that would be. Now, again, we can make some glib throwaway things like, well, if I push this guy out, out from in front of a train that's coming towards him or her, then, yeah, they're not going to get hit by a train. But life's decisions are never usually that black and white again. And usually we're talking about more nuanced thinking and choices that you have to make in real life. And so what I would say to you on that is know what you want. And as I said to one of the last chaps, know what you want. Trust that the values and thoughts that make and encompass your life are important. They should be valued. And then trust that you're basically using that template, that foundation, and building on top of that decisions that you make within your life. That way, when you make a decision, you almost put the load down because the decision is made and you can move on. And then given the updated information that may come from that decision, the future consequences or activating events that may come further down the line, then you can then negotiate and make new decisions and new choices and make new assessments of where you are with that initial choice that you made. So Jennifer, let me leave you with a concrete example. So say you are looking to buy a new car and your favorite color at the moment is lime green. You love lime green. You've just bought a whole bunch of items that are lime green. This is your color. This is your statement to the world. And you drive this car around for the next 5 years as happy as all hell. You just couldn't be happier in your car. It brings a smile to your face every time you look at it. So after 5 years, you're thinking, maybe it's time for a new car. And when you look in the classifieds to sell your car, you find that actually no one's particularly interested in lime green cars. They're interested in buying the standard colors that have better insurance groups or more customers wanting, you know, the whites, the silvers, the blacks, and the reds. And you're disappointed because you're thinking, oh, wow, I'm not even going to be able to afford or upgrade from the car that I've got. However, what about if I give you a differing bit of information? So 1 week later, after you've seen that your car is worth less in the classifieds, you get a call from a car club that is looking to buy rare and specific colors of that particular model. And they particularly will spend top dollar on lime green. They'll even pay you up to 10 times more than the standard secondhand car rate for any of the standard colors. So what we have here is that new bit of information has probably already changed your perspective, changed your mind, even changed your happiness. Now, if we look back about whether the decision to buy a lime green car initially was good or bad, well, there's one path that takes, and it gave you 5 years of happiness. But when you hit the classifieds, you maybe had a dip in your mood because you thought, oh, maybe I made an incorrect decision because I'm not going to get as much money. But then, like a couple of days later, when that car club calls you to say they'll offer you 10 times the amount for your car, so you'll be able to buy an even better new car. I hope I've managed to demonstrate in just a few brief moments that what really matters is that you trust that your decision in the moment is the correct one. Once you've laid out all the available information, you make your decision upon that. And we're talking about important decisions here, not inconsequential ones. Once you've made that decision, just trust that it is the correct one for you at that moment. Because unlike Sliding Doors the movie, where you can see both outcomes, both timelines, both streams in the world, what you will never have is that ability. And even then, even in that movie that lasts, I don't know, 2 hours, well, we don't see the consequence of that decision over the next 5, 10, or 20 years. So all we know is maybe it was the right or wrong decision in the moment or in that 2 hour period, but maybe not right for that person over the long term. The beauty of your mind is that you can always change it. You can change even the way that you view negative or consequential decisions, and you can reframe them as moments of growth or learning. Essentially, Jennifer, the choice is yours. You have the agency to change whatever you wish in your mind. I hope that helps. Right, on to the final question for this segment. This comes in from our friend in the Netherlands. This is Marcus from the Netherlands, and his question is, my outlook was always that the glass is half empty. I don't know that I can change what's been part of me since childhood. So if I deal with the last bit first, I don't know that I can change what's been part of me since childhood. That's similar to the first question when talking about DNA. And also the thought of the reductionism of environment. So one, nothing is fixed. And certainly within science, we've seen great strides in neuroplasticity. Again, the idea that we're growing new neurons all the way up to pretty much the end, which means that we can form new memories and learn new things. epigenetics, in which that there's now we see that it's not just what your gene transcribes, it's fixed. Those 20,000 genes are just fixed in what they output, but whether an environmental pressure is put on to the system determines whether it's expressed at all, and if it is expressed, is it expressed in an altered form, and also there's downstream effects. So that kind of ties up what it was, what I mentioned in the first question. And I think on this, just understand that's a false statement, and this isn't to hack on you about this. This is something that's been pervasive literally through a lot of media to a point where a lot of scientists, a lot of people in that have access to this are so sick of hearing this nature and nurture or this fixed idea. This is something that still is pervasive in general media, but certainly is almost a non-question in science at the moment. And your first part of your question is, my outlook was always that the glass is half empty. Again, this is a statement usually thrown out to define a pessimistic output. Let me be contrarian to most people on this. I would say that when people say, if I ask this question, when people say, oh, it's half full, then okay, that means they're optimistic, and if it's half empty, they're pessimistic. Okay, that could be one interpretation of that. The other interpretation is perhaps that person who says that it's half empty, and you seem to be one of them, Marcus, perhaps you look at it or can look at it as that, yes, the glass is half empty, but that means there's another part to fill up, which means that you've only learned half the things you need to. And that actually may be motivation to spur you on to actually fill up that glass to the brim. So it depends on what you do with that information. The information itself is not necessarily good or bad or positive or negative. It's how you determine, it's how you frame it. And again, it's how you can then change that mindset to either grow from that information, change direction, add or subtract actions that you need to do to move forward. So the statement itself, the glass is half empty, if we're talking about something in which that you're always looking at the darker side of a situation, and if there's no follow-up action afterwards, yeah, maybe then we can say that that's not the best use of your time or the best use of your mind to solve problems and come up with new and novel solutions. But it can also be that spark that lights the fire to go, well, you know what? My glass is only half empty, so how do I get it full? And, you know, if I flip it, if we have a look at the people that say, oh, my glass is half full, well, are they saying it because they know this is what the general public like to hear, because it's virtual signals to the world? And I like and hate that kind of expression, but it virtual signals to the world that essentially, look, I'm a good person, I'm an optimist. Okay, that could be one interpretation. The other interpretation is you're happy with it being half full. Maybe because it's half full, you already think that you've done the work to get it to that point, and so anything else is just gravy, so you won't need to work for it. So I think, my good audience, I think you can see where I'm going with this. It's how you use that information, not necessarily the information itself. So Marcus, I hope that's helped. Essentially, change your mindset on that. If you feel that it's not leading to positive outcomes or positive actions, or if it is, then potentially, so if you're doing well in your life and you're happy and your outlook is half empty, then potentially what your monkey is screaming about is the social pressure to change that thought that by saying the glass is half empty, you're a pessimist, and then socially that's not as acceptable, etc., etc. You can see how you can lead yourself down the road in which that gives you food for your monkey to then start screeching at you that you're not being the correct person for for your environment. So I hope all that helped, Marcus. So that's all, folks, in our first Q&A session dealing with how to tame, cage, and live with your monkey mind. This has been episode 4 or episode 2.1, however which way you want to register it. I hope it was useful. I hope this feedback forum has kind of worked to your benefit. I'm looking to incorporate more audio clips if you ping them over to me, and also getting my act together and interviewing you good folks live on air. So I'm basically working out the technicalities how to do this. As you can see, it's all new to me. And with all good talkback radio, I almost want that back and forth, which will be engaging for the audience and also spur me to ask better questions. So opine away. Here's my opinion. What's yours? Well, thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time. On the next episode of the Opine Motel podcast, I'm going to flesh out a little bit on the imposter syndrome. It's something in which I received quite a few questions, even for this episode. However, I thought it deserved its own episode fleshed out and a deeper explanation on what it is and perhaps how to overcome it. Good listeners, in a announcement of self-indulgence, please, if you've found anything of value, please subscribe to my podcast on your favorite podcast listening service. You can also visit my website, www.opine.network, and write a review if the need should take you. If anything has affected you in a more serious way, I highly recommend my psychological professionals in your area to explore and delve into making you live your best life. Be well. See you next time. I look forward to your company then. Thank you very much for listening. I'm LJ, your host. This has been the Opine Motel podcast. Music credits go out to the intro, Fluffy by Smith the Mister, interlude sounds by Sephiros, and to see us out, Happy Life by Freya. Be well, everyone. See you soon.